Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to another exciting installment of History Hack. Matt here, I'm on my own today, so please don't hold that against me because we have got a fascinating episode for you. Because today we are talking about Stirling Moss. When Sir Stirling died last year, it was not just motorsport fans who took pause to remember the boy. Stirling transcended motorsport, but he was far more than just the greatest driver never to win the world championship. In his new book, The Boy, Stirling Moss, A Life in 60 Laps, journalist Richard Williams looks at how Stirling Moss stood head and shoulders above those who, in the record books at least, far more laurels. Richard, thanks for joining us. How are you doing?
Hi, Matt. I'm fine, thank you. Nice to meet you.
Yes. We usually start these things with a lockdown question. How has it been for you?
I've spent so much of my life travelling, quite frankly, mostly as a sports journalist. I did 20 years pretty much non-stop. It was like being in a rock band and never having that 6 months off between albums. That actually, it probably hasn't affected me as much as it's affected many other people. I haven't minded being at home for a long period of time at all, really. I miss going out. Actually, I miss going out to hear music. I miss going to football matches, whatever, you know, of course, like everybody. But I haven't felt imprisoned. And I've had lots of writing to get on with, so that helps.
The list of gigs that never happened that won her tickets to is quite long for the last couple of years, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
So let's dive into this. I guess usually I'd ask why Stirling Moss, but I suppose that's a pretty redundant question because Stirling just was larger than life for all those years, even after he stopped racing.
Yeah, I suppose in a way the question is why another book about Stirling Moss? Because there have been many, and there were throughout his long life many. Some of them listed all his cars and described them. Some of them listed all his races and how he got on in every one of them, you know, all 500 odd of them. Several of them were authorized biographies. And, you know, they were all really interesting and all very good. But when he died in April, I felt two things. I felt that there was room for something that looked at the whole life and that looked at it from the perspective of trying to place him as a national hero in the life of the nation, in a way, what he meant to us and to the world of motor racing as well. And I also remembered that I'd begun in 1957 when I was 10 years old. I'd actually started this book in a school exercise book. Because in 1957 was really when I got interested in motor racing. And as a 10-year-old, he was my hero. He was everybody's hero in the 50s. You know, cricket meant Dennis Compton, football meant Stanley Matthews, motor racing meant Stirling Moss. And so I started writing his life story in 1957 on one side on the left-hand page, I'd write the story. On the right-hand page, I'd paste pictures of him that I cut out from my dad's newspaper. Or, you know, I had a neighbour who gave me motoring magazines, so I'd cut pictures out from that. And I guess I did that for maybe a year or so. Maddeningly, I carried that book around with me for decades, you know, moving from, you know, all the house moves I'd ever done. I know it's somewhere. I can't find it. But anyway, I thought, well, maybe now is the time to complete that book. The longest deadline in authorial history, probably. But, you know, I had very strong feelings about Stirling, still do. And in the in the intervening time from being 10 years old, I met him on quite a lot of occasions in various contexts. And I thought, well, perhaps I should do this. And I wanted to structure it in a slightly different way, rather than just writing a straightforward biography. I thought maybe a more interesting way to do it would be that Neil McGregor book, History of the World in 100 Objects. I thought maybe if I take a finite number of incidents, cars, wives and girlfriends, particular races, and devote a chapter to each one. Perhaps that's an interesting way of doing it that might be enjoyable to write and to read. So that's why it's 60 chapters, shortish, some of them a bit longer, some of them very short. And that's why it's called A Life in 60 Maps.
But let's start at the beginning. Who was he? Where was he from? Who were his people, I suppose we could say?
Yeah, well, he was born in London. His parents were an interesting couple. His dad, Alfred, owned a chain of dentist surgeries around London and the home counties. Before the war, he'd been a racer. He'd raced at Brooklands, and he'd actually studied dentistry in Indianapolis. And he'd raced in the Indy 500 when he was there and done some dirt track racing as well. I suspect that, a British driver at that time would have been quite a novelty, probably good for the box office. And Alfred Moss married a woman called Aileen Crawford, a Scottish woman who was an expert horsewoman. She competed as an equestrian. And she also was interested in motorsport. And together, Stirling's mum and dad competed in trials and hill climbs and things like that. His mother was actually a women's champion at trials. So the interest in cars was always there. When Stirling was quite small, the family moved to a farm in Berkshire. So there was lots of room. There were lots of barns where the parents kept their Rolls Royces and Alfa Romeos and, Lanciers and all kinds of things. And young Stirling and his younger sister, Pat, could ride their horses, ponies, horses. And they competed, both of them, show jumping as kids, very successfully. But Stirling could also learn to drive in an old pre-war Austin 7, which his dad had bought for 15 quid or something, converted into a kind of pickup truck for the farm. And that was the first car Stirling drove when he was 9 or 10, I think. It was a rather nice environment for children. And for him, I think it was a very nice compensation for his school days, which he didn't enjoy very much. He went to Haileybury, which was a public school. And he had some quite serious illnesses when he was a kid, which kept him off school for quite a long time. He missed several terms, which he always felt held him back academically. He quite liked sport. He was a good runner. He liked rugby. He was a winger. Hated cricket because it was too static and boring. Not enough happened for him. But he left school without having, shall we say, distinguished himself academically.
Man after my own heart, really. So after the war, he gets into racing. I think the thing we need to make clear is today there's sort of a defined route to the top, and still money does help. But for a young chap like Stirling starting out, what was the path into motor racing in the late 40s?
Well, motor racing in Britain in the 40s was a pretty informal and slightly haphazard affair. Motor racing on public roads had always been banned in Britain, or had since the early 20s, I think, which is why we didn't have any of the great road races that they had in Italy and France. So it was a bit, you know, and Brooklyn's was no, the pre-war track was no longer in use. Crystal Palace couldn't be revived. Donington Park at that point couldn't be used. So it was difficult. Really, it was sort of hill climbs and speed trials. So Stirling began in 1947 in his dad's BMW 328, which was a very nice two-seater, pre-war two-seater sports car. Powerful, good car. So he raced that in speed events and in 47. But then for the, you know, it became obvious that very early on that he had a talent and he was not remotely discouraged by his parents, who both loved motorsport, so they thought it was fine. The first plan had been, you know, since he didn't have any qualifications, he was going to try and become a waiter or work in a restaurant or something. He did a bit of that, not very happily. And he decided very early, you know, when he was 17 or 18, that he wanted to be a racing driver. So in 1948, the next step, with his family's help, was to buy a 500cc single-seater car for the new Formula, which eventually became Formula 3, which was just starting out. And this was really a British invention. A load of chaps after the war who could get their hands on bits of old saloon cars and motorcycle engines and stick them together, you know, make a formula for very small, single-seater cars. And simultaneously, people were starting to realise that there were old aerodromes lying around after the war, now disused, you know, that were actually quite good for racing on because they had perimeter tracks, flat, very nicely tarmacked. You didn't, you know, put a few straw bales up, paint a finish line, and you got a racetrack. And these little 500cc cars were perfectly suited to those tracks. His dad he had to sell a few things like his bike and his tent and his radio to his dad, who gave him the rest of the money to buy one of these new racing cars built by the Cooper Car Company in Surbiton in Surrey, who were rapidly becoming the leading builders of these little cars. All sorts of people were building their own specials to this formula and, you know, sticking their own names on them. But Cooper was a bit more professional. And eventually, of course, it became a World Championship Formula One team. But at this point, they were still drawing up the blueprints for the chassis frames on the floor of the garage in chalk. Anyway, Stirling got one of these and it very quickly became apparent that he was very good at it indeed. And he was challenging, right from the start, challenging people with much more experience and starting to build a reputation very early.
And that reputation very quickly got him into sports cars, didn't it? Which I actually think that the 50s for sports cars is possibly the greatest era for them, as much as the old Group C days were fantastic. But, you know, Jaguar, Aston Martin, everybody in those beautiful, beautiful cars racing around B roads in Northern Ireland. There's something incredible about that.
Yeah. And it was in Ireland that he really made his mark in 1950 when the Tourist Trophy was held for sports cars on the Dundrod circuit. And the Jaguar XK120 had just come out, you know, beautiful, very fast, comparatively affordable car. And this was really before Ferrari and Maserati had got their road cars going. They were building sports cars already, but, you know, the XK was a car that you could drive on the road and race. So he asked Jaguar, you know, who were just starting a racing team, if he could drive one of their cars at the TT. He was 20 years old and, you know, already had a reputation. And they said no. They said he didn't have enough experience. He thought it was because Dundrod was a dangerous circuit. And, well, all racing was dangerous in those days, but Dundrod was pretty hazardous. And they thought if this 20-year-old rising star killed himself in one of their cars, it would be terrible publicity. So what he did was borrow an XK120 from a man called Tom Wisdom, who was a racing driver, amateur racing driver, and professional motoring journalist for national papers. And Tommy Wisdom had one of these cars, and he'd been watching Moss and knew how good he was. So he said, okay, you can, I'm going to be driving something else, a Jupiter, I mean, in this race. But so you can drive my XK. And there was a Works Jaguar team and a Works Aston Martin team. And it was a long distance race on a narrow, dangerous circuit, pouring with rain, high winds, terrible conditions. And he won very convincingly ahead of all these much more experienced drivers in equally good machinery. And that really helped him make his mark. And, he said that night, the Jaguar team manager and the owner, Bill Lyons, of the company, offered him a works contract for the next season.
He really joined Jaguar at just the right time, didn't he?
He did, although he didn't have much luck with Jaguar. You know, he raced in all the big races. He came second at Le Mans in 1953, I think, which was his best result ever at Le Mans. It was probably the one big race he was destined never to win, but he certainly helped them build a reputation as a top sports car team. And, you know, in those days, racing at Le Mans, winning the Mille Miglia or the Targa Florio or the Tourist Trophy, was thought to be great publicity for your road cars. Whether you were Jaguar or Mercedes or whoever. So he did a lot for them from that point of view. But maybe it was with Jaguar that he began to get a reputation for being either unlucky or too hard on his cars. And it's probably true that, he could drive the cars harder and faster than almost anybody else, and that possibly put more strain on them than others. But once or twice at Le Mans, he was sent out to set such a fast pace from the start of the 24-hour race that the other manufacturers' cars would be tempted to try and keep up with him, and they would blow up. And the price of that was that he would eventually blow up as well. For instance, at Le Mans in 1959, when he was driving for Aston Martin in the DBR1s, he went out and did exactly that and destroyed the Ferrari team just through the pace he set, which allowed the second and third Aston Martins to come first and second in the race. And he'd long retired because he'd done to his car what he'd done to the Ferraris as well.
I think we need to mention Mr. Ferrari now, because this is one of those great bits of the Moss legends, isn't it? Because it's his father, and he receives a phone call to race for Ferrari in Formula One, and it doesn't quite go to plan, and it remains needle for the best part of a decade, doesn't it?
It was in 1951 when he was racing for HWM, a British team, in Formula 2, 2-litre cars, single-seaters. And although he wasn't really winning races because the HWMs weren't very reliable, he was putting up such good performances that Enzo Ferrari took notice of him. And the first thing he did was get in touch with Moss and offer him a drive at the French Grand Prix at Reims and the British Grand Prix at Silverstone. Moss, who was an honourable chap, was already committed to HWM for the race in France. So he said, I can't do that, but I'll race at Silverstone. Ferrari said, no, I need a driver for both those races. So he gave it to an Argentine called Jose Fualan Gonzalez, who was a friend of Fangio's. And Fangio won the race at Silverstone, which was a very historic victory because he beat the Alfa Romeos for the first time. So, I think Ferrari was happy with Gonzalez at that point. So kind of Moss had, he'd lost out there through, you know, behaving honourably. But then Ferrari said, OK, you can come and race my new Formula 2 car at Bari in Italy, on the east coast of Italy, down in Puglia. So Moss said, fine. So he and his dad made the very long journey down to Puglia, very long in those days, you know, 1951, no motorways, no anything. So you know, they flew and took a train, and eventually they got to Bari, and they went to the garage where they knew the Ferrari team had set up in the town. And there was the new Formula 2 car, and Moss went up to it and, you know, was about to jump in and try out the seat and the steering wheel and the pedals. And the mechanic said, no. You know, that's not your car. There's been a change of plan. Piero Taruffi, Italian, much more experienced, he's going to drive it. So Moss, as you can imagine, was incandescent with disappointment. Enzo Ferrari was quite a long way away in Modena. You know, he didn't go to the races, so he wasn't there to argue the toss with. So Sterling and his dad had to swallow their anger. And eventually they went back to England, nursing a grudge, understandably. And that did two things, really. It put Moss off Ferrari for quite a long time to come. And it also made him, I mean, he was a very patriotic person. A lot of people were in the 50s. It made him want to drive a British car to success in Formula One racing. Now, you know, there wasn't much around in those days if you wanted to drive a British car. So, you know, that made life difficult for him for a number of years. He had to eventually had to compromise on that, but not, Ferrari kept offering him, you know, when as his reputation grew and grew and grew, Ferrari kept saying, come and drive for me, come and drive for me. And Moss just, you know, turned him down out of hand every time for a long time until, as I guess we'll talk about later, right in the back end of his career. But it was a very formative experience, that grave disappointment in Bari.
Just to say, that is a wonderful part of the world, though.
Oh, yeah.
Puglia. I spent a summer there. It's just absolutely delightful.
Yeah,
So if you're going to be terribly disappointed, it's a nice place to...
I don't think the scenery, you know, I don't think going to look at the beautiful village, hill villages of Puglia was really on Sterling's mind at that point.
So there's rumours bubbling around about this time of the fallout with Ferrari that Mercedes may return. I find sort of this fascinating that we live in an age of Mercedes domination, and the thought of Mercedes coming back sort of filled people with a little bit of dread because they had dominated pre-war, and famously, as your previous book also told the story of, had a very fast, charismatic British driver as well. So everybody was looking to Stuttgart to see whether or not they were coming, because it was essentially the same setup, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, Mercedes had dominated before the First World War, before the Second World War, and now they were coming back again. And everybody knew that, you know, if Mercedes were coming back, they were coming back to dominate again. So at the end of 1953, when it was known that they were on their way back, Sterling and his dad and his manager, Ken Gregory, got in touch with the Mercedes management, which, you know, as you said, was this basically the same people they'd had before the war. And said, any chance of a seat in your team for 1954, your Grand Prix team? And Alfred Neubauer, the great team manager at Mercedes, he'd seen Sterling quite a lot and he'd been impressed. And he said, no, you're not ready yet. So, you know, just wait, not this year. So Sterling knew, he tried out every British car available, the BRM, the Connaught, the Vanwall, which was a new a new make, backed by a millionaire industrialist. There used to be people called millionaire industrialists in the 50s, and Tony Vanderbilt was one of them. But Moss decided that these cars were all just not good enough, basically. They didn't have the resources behind them that the Ferrari or Mercedes or Maserati had. So he didn't want to drive for Ferrari. He couldn't drive for Mercedes. So then the option really was Maserati, who were building a very nice new car called the 250F. So he got in touch with Maserati and they said, no, we're entering three works cars and we've got three Argentinian drivers to drive them because we're getting some money from the Argentinian government. But we are also building three cars for customers, which will cost you, you know, you want to buy one of those, it'll cost you £5,000. A lot of money in those days. So Moss's dad, Alfred Moss, decided, let's do that, because Stirling was actually away in America at the time when this decision was made. Moss's dad made the decision that the car would be bought. Stirling would have to pay for it out of his winnings and, you know, starting money and other things.
Selling his radio to his dad wasn't going to cut it this time.
No, it wasn't. Not for a 250F. So the car arrived and it was painted green, as he'd asked, unlike the works cars, which were, of course, Italian red. It was going to be looked after by his own team, by his own mechanics, working out of his dad's farm. And it did well enough in that season, including at the beginning of the season, that Maserati realized that, well, actually, he's going better than our works drivers. And when one of the works drivers, very sadly, was killed at the Nürburgring, and Stirling had performed very well in his privately entered car, Maserati said, well, look, come and drive with us. We'll paint your car red. You can have the works mechanics. You can have all the latest modifications, you know, the new engine, whatever we've got. So effectively, he ran the second half of the season as a works Maserati driver and came very, very, very close to winning the Italian Grand Prix, until the car broke down very late while he was leading convincingly, beating the Mercedes. So that was, you know, at that point he was already a Grand Prix winner in all but name. And, you know, once again, he'd sent a message to the Mercedes management saying, you know, I'm ready.
The 250F is one of those cars that looks like it's doing 180 miles an hour standing still, doesn't it? It's gorgeous. Not an easy car to drive, and very few were actually successful in it.
Well, it was, I think it wasn't, no racing cars of that era were easy to drive, but if you were a top driver, I think it was a very satisfying car to drive because its behavior was predictable. It didn't have any vices. You know, the more virtuosity you put into driving it, the better the results. And it just had that thing. It had such a beautiful shape. You know, if you asked a little boy in the 1950s to draw a racing car, it would come out looking like a Maserati 250F. It was just perfect proportions. And its handling was like that too. So there are many pictures of Stirling taking corners in a Maserati 250F, you know, where the car is, the wheels are not pointing the direction that the car is traveling in, because in those days you drove the car through the input of the throttle. So the car was drifting. That's the famous four-wheel drift, of which Fangio and Moss were the masters. And it's a beautiful thing to watch. It still is if you go to a historic car race and you see somebody driving, you know, an old Maserati really well. It won't be quite the same because they're on fatter tyres nowadays with much more grip. In those days, you know, they were like bicycle tyres. So the cars would drift easily and beautifully. But it was a fantastic thing to see. So in a way, you know, the 250F was to Moss as a Stradivarius would have been to Yehudi Menuhin. You know, it was the perfect instrument.
And it sounds as good as it looks. I just love that car. I think everybody loves 250. Yeah. But we digress, because there's a silver elephant in the room. It's 1955, and Herr Neubauer decides that the boy is ready for his cars, and he's up against a bit of a challenge in his teammate, isn't he?
He is, because his teammate is Juan Manuel Fangio, who was already a world champion and on his way to 5 world championships in the end. And by that time, Fangio was the sort of presiding genius of Formula One, I think everybody recognised, particularly once Alberto Ascari, who'd been the champion in 52 and 53, once he was killed early in 1955. Fangio didn't really have a rival. And the combination of Fangio and the Mercedes W196, you know, lovely 8-cylinder, very powerful, very reliable, strong Formula One car, was unbeatable. But for Moss, it was a great opportunity. You know, he would be the number two driver, there was no doubt about that, but it was a great opportunity for him to follow in Fangio's wheel tracks. You know, numerous times that year, they finished first and second. Very close company. It was his finishing school, really, you know, sitting a few feet behind Fangio at, you know, 150 miles an hour. And Fangio, you know, went on to win. Sure enough, went on to win his third world championship that year. But Moss did win his first world championship Grand Prix at Aintree in the British Grand Prix on the perimeter track of the Grand National course, running in the other direction, running clockwise, that's right, because the Grand National goes anti-clockwise, but in front of those great wooden grandstands that they have for the Grand National. And he led most of the race. Fangio led a bit of it. And in the end, he finished a few feet ahead of Fangio. Now, you know, the debate goes on. All these, you know, more than half a century later, did Fangio let him win? Because it was good publicity, because they got on very well, they were friends. And obviously it would be great for Moss to win in front of the British crowd, his maiden world championship victory. Fangio never gave any indication that he'd let Moss win that race. But it certainly was good for everybody. You know, it worked out very well. Moss, you know, would admit that, you know, maybe Fangio let him win. At that point, he knew. He always said Fangio was better than me in single-seaters. I was better than him in sports cars. He was, you know, he certainly grew to be as good as Fangio in single-seaters. But at that point, probably, he was still, you know, it was right that he finished runner-up in the World Championship for the first time to the great man.
Just to the listener, if you've not Googled that Aintree race, and to see just how close Fangio was as they crossed the line, do. But it is absolutely wonderful, because in the background, you can just see the stands literally losing their minds to see Moss cross the line first. Silver car. It's wonderful, wonderful Pathé footage. Yeah. But you did mention the sports cars, and we cannot, or I'm not going to let you get away without chatting about the Mille Miglia, because not only is that possibly one of the greatest wins, it also gave us possibly one of the greatest motorsport articles ever in Jenks' is write-up, because just describe what the Mille Miglia was. It is what it says on the tin, but what was it, if people don't know what it is?
Well, the Mille Miglia, which means 1,000 miles, was started in the before the war as 1,000-mile race around the top half of Italy, basically. It started in Brescia. It went down the right-hand side, the Adriatic coast, and then across to Rome, across the width of Italy, through the mountains, and then up through Tuscany, basically, through Florence and Siena and Bologna, and all the way back to Brescia on closed roads. That 1,000 miles would be entirely closed insofar as was possible, you know, apart from the odd flock of sheep or chicken or sort of stray child. And level crossings. There were level crossings which were closed. But the cars would set off at 1 minute intervals, and they'd the first ones would go off after midnight sometime. Maybe they started at midnight. And the number on your car would correspond to the time that you set off. So, for instance, in 1955, Moss's Mercedes sports car carried the number 722, which meant that he started at 22 minutes past seven in the morning. And the slowest would go off first. So you'd have all these Fiat Topolinos and tiny little, you know, weird things going off. And then eventually you'd get the big cars like the Mercedes and the Ferraris, which were more or less Formula One cars with an extra seat and bodywork with wings and lights. So it was a fantastic spectacle. I mean, just unimaginable now to see them. And Moss had driven it a few times before without much luck. And one year, while he was driving for Jaguar, he'd done several reconnaissance laps with a mechanic. And they'd tried making notes on the course because, you know, you can't learn 1,000 miles like you could learn Brands Hatch or, you know, Monaco. You know, it's always going to be a bit approximate. But in 1955, you know, because Mercedes was such a professional operation, this gave him the opportunity to refine that idea. So he invited a man called Dennis Jenkinson, who was a motoring journalist, he was the Continental correspondent of Motorsport, and a wonderful, wonderful character and journalist, who'd actually won a world championship himself as the sidecar passenger to a man called Eric Oliver in the World Sidecar Championships, I think around beginning of the 50s anyway. So he, you know, was clearly fearless, had some experience of being a passenger at high speed.
Hanging off the side at high speed.
So, and he was a great fan of Moss, you know, as well. I admired him very much. So Moss said, well, why don't you come along? And we'll do several reconnaissance laps and we'll make notes. So they cooked up. And I think with the aid of another Mercedes driver, John Fitch, he may have had some input into this as well. What they did was make an aluminium box with a little Perspex window. And they did three or four reconnaissance laps during which they wrote off two Mercedes cars.
Not just any cars, there were 300 SLs, weren't they?
One of them was one of the real, yeah, exactly. And they finished up. Mercedes said, we're not giving you any more of those. You can have a saloon car for the last go round. And Jenkinson made these fantastically detailed notes, you know, level crossing, humpback bridge, sharp right hander, you know, hairpin to the left, blah, blah, blah. And wrote them all down on effectively a roll of lavatory paper, which was then put on a spindle inside this aluminium box with a handle. And he could turn it, roll it round. And read the notes through the Perspex window as they went along, sitting in the passenger seat of this racing car. And they had to have hand signals, of course, because, you know, an unsilenced 3-litre, 8-cylinder racing engine wouldn't have been able to hear very much. So they devised signal. It worked. That's all you can say. It worked a treat. You know, they were racing against the best Grand Prix drivers of the day and the fastest sports cars in the world, including Fangio. Fangio drove single-handed. He had no navigator, co-driver person, as did most of the others. But using this kind of super system of signals, Moss and Jenkinson got round in just over 10 hours, which was an average of just under 100 miles an hour, 99 miles an hour. Imagine on public roads, no motorways anywhere, of course. You know, we're talking about, you know, country roads, mountain passes through the Apennines,
Lined with people in many places.
Lined with people everywhere. Yes, just incredible. You know, can you imagine battering through the middle of Siena? You know, the streets lined with ten deep people, and going absolutely full chat, or ten tenths, as Sterling always called it, and winning this historic victory, which was, you know, in many ways the most remarkable victory of his career. They said, you know, 2 years later the race was stopped because, well, there were two more editions, and then it wasn't held anymore because it was too many people were getting killed. It was too dangerous. So his record stands in perpetuity, an amazing thing. And that season for Mercedes, he also won the Targa Florio and the TT, which meant that they won the World Sports Car Championship, which was very important to them because they were finishing racing at the end of the season. There had been the terrible disaster at Le Mans, where one of the Mercedes cars driven by a French driver, Pierre Lévêque, flew into the crowd in front of the grandstands and killed 80-odd people. The race went on to a finish, amazingly. That was the way things were in those days.
Hawthorn won that with the Jaguar, didn't he?
Hawthorn won it with the Jaguar, mostly because in the middle of the night, several hours after this catastrophe, the Mercedes team pulled out when Fangio and Moss were co-driving one Mercedes car, and they were leading, and they would, you know, that car wouldn't have broken down, and it was faster than the D-Type. So they would have won that race. Neither of them ever won Le Mans. But the team withdrew in the middle of the night, packed up the cars, and, you know, went home. But anyway, they were able to finish the season with the World Championship Formula One driver and the runner-up, and the World Sports Car Championship. And then they called it a day.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I suppose the great rivalry was with Mike Hawthorn. What wonderfully dapper gent, always in a bow tie. And after the Mercedes years, Moss would find himself up against him, especially in 1958. Who was Mike Hawthorn? Because he was, for that brief time, as big as Moss, really. For school boys, you were a Moss fan or you were a Hawthorn fan.
Yeah, it was like Beatles or the Stones, really. It was a great rivalry. Hawthorn arrived a little bit after Moss. He was born in Yorkshire. He was the son of a man with a background in motor racing who ran a garage in Farnham in Surrey. So once again, you know, he had parental encouragement. And he made his first impact unlike most of that generation, he didn't race 500cc Formula 3 cars. He started off in a Riley sports car and then a Cooper Bristol Formula 2 car. And then, you know, 1953, he got the Ferrari contract that Moss had kept turning down. And, you know, he used it to very good effect, because that year at Reims, he won, you know, he became the first British driver to win a World Championship Grand Prix, edging out Fangio in a Maserati, and beating all the other works Ferrari and Maserati drivers. That was quite a coup. And they were very different types. Moss was the complete professional. You know, white helmet, white overalls usually. You know, kept himself fit. Didn't drink very much, smoked a bit, but, you know, looked after himself. Kept away from women for a few nights before the race. Hawthorn was the opposite, completely the opposite. Hawthorn after a race, you know, if he was racing at Goodwood, you know, on the way home to Farnham from the race meeting, he'd stop off at a pub or possibly three. You know, he and his mate Peter Collins, who was the other British star of the 50s, you know, they got up to lots of larks, often involving women in, you know, wherever they happened to be racing at the time. You know, they were sort of good time boys. Hawthorn was a very good driver, no doubt about that, but he had bad days. Moss never really had an off day. He was one of the things about him was that he was a very consistent driver. You know, he could produce his best on any given day in any car. Hawthorn wasn't like that. He could be really, really quick. He did have health problems, some quite deep-lying health problems that probably contributed to that. He wasn't as classical a stylist as Moss. You know, you watched Moss driving and you saw something, you know, whether you knew anything about cars or cared about racing, you knew you were looking at something beautiful. Hawthorn was a little bit more rudimentary in his driving. He was very quick, but not the same kind of aesthetic experience watching him. But they were the great rivals at that time. And it was a rivalry that reached its climax in 1958. In 1956 and 57, Moss had become established as a winner, a Grand Prix winner. In 56, he'd gone back to Maserati and he'd won at Monaco and Monza. And he'd finished again runner-up in the World Championship to Fangio. And then in 57, he joined the Van Wall team run by Tony Vanderbilt, because at last he felt here was a British team with which he could win Grand Prix and probably the World Championship. That was the idea. He'd raced once for Van Wall in 56, the International Trophy at Silverstone, and won the race against good opposition. So that convinced him. And Vanderbilt offered him a decent deal as the number one driver in the team for 57. And it was a great season. He and Tony Brooks co-drove the Van Wall that won the British Grand Prix at Aintree that year. The first time British drivers in a British car had won the British Grand Prix. But then Moss won two more Grand Prix that season, one at Pescara and the other at Monza, which was beating the Italians on their own soil, which in a way was even more satisfying, because Vanderbilt was like Moss. You know, he wanted to beat the red cars for patriotic reasons. And that they'd done it. So 1958 looked like being a very good season. You know, the prospects were great. They had what, you know, was clearly the fastest car, seemed to be. Hawthorn and Collins were driving for Ferrari. And Ferrari had a new car, a very good new car, Dino 246. Moss started the season. The Van Wals weren't ready at the beginning of the season for the Argentinian Grand Prix in Buenos Aires. So Moss went there with a little Cooper. The formula was for 2.5 litre cars, and he had a little rear engine Cooper that was only had a 2 litre engine. But by dint of great strategy and making his tyres last the whole race, you know, he finished the race, they were down to the canvas, you know, the rubber had worn away, they were about to go pop. but he managed to finish, you know, 3 seconds ahead of the nearest Ferrari. The Ferraris had thought he was going to make a pit stop, and had thought, oh, well, don't worry, we'll get him before the end. And then they realised too late that they weren't going to. So that was the first post-war victory for a rear-engine car, very historic. And of course, you know, trend-setting, because eventually all Formula One cars would become rear-engine. But that was, you know, a big moment. But then the Van Wals were ready for the rest of the season. You know, it was obviously going to... Once Collins had been killed at the Nürburgring, very sadly, the championship was obviously going to be between Moss and Hawthorn. Eventually, Hawthorn won it by a single point. And the only reason for that, he'd won one Grand Prix in the season. Moss had won four. But because the scoring system was the way it was in those days, you know, you got good points for coming second or third, and Hawthorn had 5 second places in the third and the fifth. In the end, he had more points than Moss. One more point. Now, what had happened, 3 races from the end of the season in Portugal at Porto, was that Moss was winning the race easily. When Hawthorn was about to finish second, distant second, but he stalled his car. He spun, stalled his car. Engine stopped. The only way to get it started, no starter on Formula One cars in those days, was to push it, get out and push and jump in. And he tried to do that, but the circuit was a bit uphill at that point. So he turned it round and push started it on the pavement. And got going again and finished second. And while he was pushing it and getting it started, Moss went past on his lap of honour. Pulled in at the end of the race, finished. Hawthorn finished second. The stewards immediately called Hawthorn up and disqualified him because you weren't allowed to push start your car against the direction of the circuit, which is what he'd had to do to get it going downhill. And Moss heard about that and he went into the stewards and said, no. Hold on, I saw him and he wasn't on the circuit, which is what the regulations say you have to be, or, you know, to, you know. He was on the pavement, so that means you can't disqualify him. It was all right. So Hawthorn, they undisqualified Hawthorn, they let his second place stand, thanks to Moss's testimony. And with it, he kept the point that he'd earned for the fastest lap. 2 races later, they went to Casablanca for the Grand Prix of Morocco, the last race of the season. Moss needed to finish first and get the fastest lap, and for Hawthorn to finish no better than third if Moss was going to win his first world championship. Well, he kept his part of the bargain. He finished first and he got the point for the fastest lap. Hawthorn was in third place, but he was behind his teammate, a young American called Phil Hill. And Hill, being a good teammate before the end of the race, let Hawthorn through into second place, which allowed him to win the championship by a single point. The single point, you know, you could say had come in Portugal when Moss had made his gesture. So Moss never complained. You know, that was the way things were. He believed at that point, because he was at the height of his powers, you know, he was 29 years old. You know, still functioning, you know, brilliantly. There would be a chance the next year or the year after. So he never, ever complained about that or said he wished he hadn't made that gesture at Porto. And Hawthorn became, therefore, the first British world champion. And sadly, he was killed in a road accident a few weeks later.
Mm. You see, I've often wondered if it hadn't have been an Englishman, if he'd have been so sporting.
I think he would have been, actually. I don't think it made any difference. He and Hawthorn, they had a very cordial relationship. But underneath, they didn't really like each other very much. Collins, who was Hawthorne's best buddy, got on very well with Moss. He was a very sympathetic character. They drove together to win the Targa Florio. But with Hawthorne, it was a much, you know, under the surface, it was a pricklier relationship.
I think my favourite part of Stirling's story is his relationship with Rob Walker. In this period, you had privateers who would buy a car, enter it, and off they go. Later on, you'd have the, you know, what was it, Hesketh saying you could buy a chassis, buy an engine and win a Grand Prix. But this was a chap who was Walker, as in Johnny Walker, and just had an absolute passion for the sport and supplied cars and, you know, did the whole nine yards for the cars for some of the great drivers of the 50s and 60s.
Well, Rob Walker was quite a character. He'd driven at Le Mans before the war in his own Delahaye, and he'd done well. He finished the race quite high up. He drove the whole race in a pinstripe suit. And at his last pit stop, he got out and had a swig from the last bottle of the champagne that the mechanics had been consuming, and got back in and finished the race. He got married after the war, and he promised his wife that he wouldn't drive anymore, but that didn't stop him entering cars. So he became a private entrant, entering cars for other drivers. And as you know, as we said, in 58, he'd entered the Cooper at Buenos Aires that Moss won with, and they had a great friendship. Moss loved driving for him. You know, it was a handshake relationship. He trusted him. He knew that if he said he wanted to enter a particular race, Walker would send a car with the mechanics. And if he wanted to drive in a race for somebody else, that was fine with Walker. So it was the best of all worlds, except he was never going to get cutting-edge machinery that you would get from a works team. So his cars were always going to be 6 months or a year behind the best of the opposition. And in a way, that appealed to something within Moss. Over the years, you know, he'd been, you know, he'd had, you know, what was known as the Moss jinx or the hoodoo, or, you know, or he'd been accused of breaking cars. So he'd kind of got used to being the underdog, and he liked that. I think that became part of his, what we would call today, his brand, which nobody would have thought of calling it then. But it was part of his appeal, and he liked that. And the idea of he and this heir to a whiskey fortune sort of taking on the world was very appealing to him. And, you know, he had a great mechanic, Alf Francis, who'd come over, Polish mechanic who'd come over during the war, fought in the Polish Armoured Corps, and then got a job as a racing mechanic with various teams, and had been Moss's mechanic on Moss's own Maserati. And they trusted each other, you know. Disagreed a lot, had lots of rows, but, you know, it worked well. So from then on, Moss raced in Grand Prix cars in Walker's cars, which were either Coopers or Lotuses with Climax engines, Coopers to begin with. Then when Colin Chapman's Lotus became clearly the quicker car, Walker bought one for Moss. And they were quick but very fragile cars. So, you know, Moss had two of his worst accidents in Lotuses when bits fell off or something happened. Something mysterious probably happened. But they took enormous satisfaction from beating the factory teams with their private entry. It didn't, you know, it was, their success was patchy. 59 and 60, Jack Brabham and the Works Coopers won the championships. Clearly, you know, they were more reliable and very quick. Moss was driving Cooper. They wanted to use the same gearbox as Coopers, but Coopers wouldn't let them. They wouldn't sell them a gearbox. So they went to an Italian guy that Al Francis knew called Valerio Colotti, who made a very nice gearbox, but a very unreliable one, and was nice in every other way. And, you know, Moss led Grand Prix after Grand Prix only for the gearbox to break, which unreasonably exaggerated his reputation for breaking cars and being unkind to cars. It wasn't him, it was Colotti. You know, in 1961, they faced their biggest challenge when the formula changed. It went from 2.5 litre to 1.5 litre cars. And the British teams thought that this was being done to spoil their chances because they were so dominant by that time. And that it was being done to help Ferrari, who'd been working on a very good 1.5 litre engine and car for some time. So the British teams weren't really ready for it. And so it proved, you know, Ferrari came out with a fleet of fantastic 1.5 litre cars, which had this twin nostril nose. So they became a little bit like sharks. So they became known as the shark noses. With good drivers, Phil Hill, Wolfgang von Trips, Richie Ginter. And, you know, they were clearly miles quicker than the British cars. However, you know, that handicap gave Moss the chance on the two real driver's circuits of the year, Monaco, you know, a very tight, twisty street circuit, and the Nürburgring, you know, 14-mile circuit with 174 corners and endless hazards all over the place. You know, you'd end up, you know, you went off at Nürburgring, you'd end up, you know, down a hillside in the middle of a forest. And at those two tracks, Moss, you know, just produced his ultimate virtuoso performances to beat the Ferraris against all the odds in this obsolete Lotus, four-cylinder Lotus that he was driving. And those really are the two great Formula One victories of his career, and they're the things that are probably best remembered when his, you know, his talent was in its fullest flower. And you could see that he, you know, after Fangio's retirement, he was the undisputed number one in Formula One.
Let's talk about 1962. There's a lot going on in that final season. Spoiler for if you don't know what happens, because the Ferrari animosity has bubbled away, and there's a deal in place for 1963, which is unique, really,
62.
For 62, yes, for Ferrari, because they were going to let their cars race in different colors, weren't they?
Yes, Ferrari had lent out cars occasionally. He'd lent them to a Belgian team a bit, okay, for the Belgian Grand Prix. But as a rule, he didn't. By the end of 1961, I think Moss was fed up with not driving a Ferrari, basically, because it was so obvious how much better they'd been in 1961. And he must have been reflecting on how many championships he would have won had he accepted, you know, Ferrari's offer in the mid-50s. You know, he would probably have won 3 or 4 world championships by then. He went to Modena and sat down with Ferrari. Ferrari took him to lunch in his private room at the Cavallino restaurant across the road from the factory. And they talked mostly in French, I think, because Ferrari didn't speak any English and Moss didn't speak very much Italian, but they both spoke a bit of French. And they came to this historic agreement that in 1962, Moss would drive for Ferrari. But the cars, although they would be absolutely the same as the works team were getting, and they would be built, you know, according to Moss's desires. You know, if he said, you know, I'd like this on the car, or I'd like it to do that, that, you know, they'd be built according to that. They'd be painted in Rob Walker's colours, blue with a white noseband with a number on. And they'd be run by a combination of the works team and the Walker team. And that would be for Formula One, sports cars, and GT cars with the new 250 GTO, which, as we now know, go for $30 million a pop, if you're one of the 36 people lucky enough to own.
I remember chatting to Derek Bell about him selling his for next to nothing, and and sees them go now and just bangs his head against the wall.
Well, I've been driven in one up the hill at Goodwood by Jochen Mass.
Oh, wow.
And I think they were only worth about 10 million then, but even so, it was a pretty awe-inspiring experience just to be in one. Anyway, so that was the deal. And that was the deal for 1962. It looked like a very good one, you know. How could it fail? Basically. So it was going to start at the beginning of the Grand Prix season. Pretty much. So there were early season races at which Moss was still going to drive the Rob Walker Lotus and, you know, Cooper sports car and bits and bobs. So that's what he did at the beginning of 62, in mind that the Ferrari was going to come along very soon. On Easter Monday, April the 23rd, I think, that he went to race in the Glover Trophy, which was a Formula One race, a non-championship race, at Goodwood with what had been Rob Walker's Lotus 1821, a modified Lotus 18, an obsolete car, basically, against a good field, Graham Hill in a BRM, Jim Clark in a Lotus, John Surtees in one of the new Lolas. Moss set the fastest lap. Pole position, had a bad start to the race, worked his way back up. It was a problem with the gear linkage, got it sorted out in a pit stop. And he'd worked his way back to fourth place with only a few laps to go when he came up behind Graham Hill, who was leading the race. And he was, you know, he was about to unlap himself when, through something that's never been satisfactorily explained, he left the road, went over the grass, bumped over a kind of gully and hit an earth bank. Probably at that point doing about 70 miles an hour, having, you know, gone down from maybe 120. Head on into the earth bank. Clearly haven't been able to do anything to steer it away from that. And the front of the car just crumpled up. These were very lightweight cars in those days. There was no safety cell of any sort. So it took 3/4 hour to cut him out of the car. Luckily, amazingly, it didn't catch fire, which was what often happened in those days. The St. John ambulance were on the scene quite quickly, and then, you know, mechanics turned up with the equipment for cutting the chassis tubes to free him. He was completely unconscious. He'd broken quite a lot of things, and quite a lot of physical injuries. But the worst thing was that his head had smashed forward into the steering wheel, and he'd hit the left side of his head very badly, which had smashed his eye socket, but also sent his brain jolting around and done serious damage to that. He was in a coma for 30-odd days in hospital. It was obviously, the crash was, you know, the front page lead on all the newspapers the next day, because he was such a national hero. And his condition, you know, was on the front pages for weeks. Daily bulletins, you know, will he recover? Then will he, when he came out of the coma, will he race again? He rather ill-advisedly gave one interview to a newspaper. He paid £10,000 for it, which was, you know, a fortune that day, when he was still pretty groggy. Saying, yes, I'll be back at the racing in a couple of months. which people didn't discount, you know, because he'd made miraculous recoveries from before, you know, in 1960, also in a Lotus. He'd broken his back in several places and both his legs, and he'd been racing, you know, in the top line within 7 weeks. He had phenomenal powers of recovery, phenomenal. So people thought, well, you know, good chance he's going to come out of this. But gradually the extent of his, of the damage, much more than physical damage, you know, the damage that had been caused by the bang to his brain became apparent. And it was a year before he got into a racing car again. And he went back to Goodwood, funnily enough, a year later, with a Lotus sports car that he'd raced before several times. And he lapped for half an hour or so on a bit of a dull day. And he came in after half an hour, having, you know, lapped pretty quickly. But he said, it's not the same. You know, whatever mechanism, you know, joins the brain to the feet and the hands, it's just not, the perceptions are not the same. When he got out of the car, you know, he said, I'm now a retired racing driver. That's it. Later, when he'd recovered a bit more, reflected in tranquility, he thought that he'd made that test, put himself to that test prematurely, that if he'd given it, you know, a few more months or maybe a year, he would have felt that all his own, his old perceptions, you know, were back, and that everything had sort of knitted itself, you know, back into the kind of neural muscular network. But he'd made his decision, and he stuck to it as far as being a professional racing driver went. You know, if he'd left it another year and he'd felt okay, he'd still only have been in his mid-30s. And he certainly had been expecting to race all the way through his 30s. You know, Fangio had gone on well into his 40s, mm-hmm. you know, 49 when he retired, still world champion.
So what does Sterling do next? Because he just then turned his hand to lots of things. He built that wonderful, wonderful house. And
yeah, he you know, he was always very keen on earning a living. So he went to work for the American Worldwide of Sports program as a commentator in Europe and in America. He commentated on American races. Well, he liked America. He always had done. He started a little property empire. He bought apartment blocks in London, central London, and rented them to people, and was very meticulous about that. You know, he did most of the repairs himself.
Called the landlord, and Stirling Moss shows up with a bag of tools.
Exactly. And, you know, that's one of the reasons, you know, in London, he lived in Mayfair. He usually had a scooter or a moped. And one of the reasons was that, you know, any of his properties was only 10 minutes away if he needed to go and empty the electricity meter or, you know, put a new light bulb in the hall or something. So he did quite a lot of that. But he also, you know, he had a home for a while in Nassau in the Bahamas, a place he loved. And when he was married for the first time to his wife, Katie, he built a holiday home for them in Nassau, which I think he gave to her as part of the divorce at the end of the 60s. You know, he lived, carried on living a pretty full life. And I don't know if you remember when he fell down a lift shaft. He built himself a house in the 60s in Mayfair and Shepherd Market, which became famous for all its electronic gadgets, devices, you know, electric garage doors, which, you know, the late 50s, that was something. A bath, you could, you know, you could start the bath, start the water and regulate the temperature from anywhere in the house. And it also had a lift. And he went down three stories, I think. This is a terraced townhouse. It had this lift. And when he was 80, he still had the house. he was standing by the lift talking to somebody. He was about to get in, the lift doors opened and he got in, and the lift car wasn't there. So he fell 30 feet onto a concrete floor, concrete base of the lift shaft. 80 years old, shattered both his ankles, other abrasions. And shock, I should think, you know, worst nightmare. But the weird thing is that 6 months later, he was driving at Goodwood in the revival meeting in his 2 litre Oscar. 2 litre Oscar sports car, and I was there watching him. You know, he was racing the thing; he was drifting it. I just thought, what sort of a man is this? Phenomenal. You know, although I've followed his career the last few years of his professional career, I'd never seen him race in anger in his prime. But I did see him at the end of the 70s. Driving a van wall at Monza. And I saw him lots of other times in historics. And, you know, just to see that white helmet, you know, those white or pale blue overalls, that straight arm stance in the cockpit was such a thrill for people. And he knew that, you know, he was completely aware of that and he loved it. And he loved giving that to his fans. And he always said that, you know, he was asked to tell stories over and over again. You know, he'd meet somebody for the first time and they'd say, oh, tell me about the Mille Miglia in 1955, or, you know, tell me about the time you and Brooks won the British Grand Prix. And he told these stories, you know, I heard them from him. He told them with the same enthusiasm that he would have told them the first time. And he did that, he said, because although he was telling them for the millionth time, the person he was telling them to was hearing them from him for the first time. And he felt, you know, they deserved that, to hear it that way. That was a fantastic thing.
The measure of the man. I think that's a lovely point to wrap this up. Richard, just tell us the name of the book again, because we're recording it on release day today, aren't we?
We are. The book is called The Boy, Stirling Moss, A Life in 60 Laps.
Richard Williams, thank you so much. I am going to drag you back so we can talk about Dick Seaman next time.
Thank you, Matt. That would be a pleasure too.
Super. Thank you so much. I'd like to thank Richard Williams once again for joining us on History Hack. We've put The Boy, Stirling Moss, A Life in 60 Laps on our very own bookshop, along with Richard's other book about Dick Seaman, which we're going to get him back, which is called A Race with Love and Death, and his incredible book about the Pescara Grand Prix in 1957 that we mentioned. It's called The Last Road Race. 10% of every purchase through our bookshop comes towards us and helps us keep the podcast going and sees us through these tricky times. Head to bookshop.org/shop/historyhack to pick up your next great read. There are other ways to support the pod as well, because now it's the Patreon bit. In 2020, when the boss ladies, Alex and Alina, started History Hack, the world was very strange, and unfortunately, it looks like 2021 is going to be equally strange. We would love it if you're able to support the podcast in any way. It will allow us to keep up the regularity of the pods, and also the great guests that we've been able to bring you over the last year. We exist on Patreon as History Hack, and also on Podbean, our podcast host's own platform called Patreon. The reward tiers are being updated at the moment, so there's going to be some fantastic options for you to choose from. So if you're able to support us, that would be fantastic. So we thank you very much, and until the next time.